You can subscribe to The Spectator for 12 weeks for only £12 for our print and online editions, plus get 6 months of digital access free to The Telegraph. Go to spectator.co.uk/telegraph.
Hello and welcome to a special edition of Coffee House Shots. Thank you for joining us today as part of the Spectator's Alternative Conference. We are going to do a half an hour edition of our daily podcast. I'm just going to go through our panel today before we get to what we'll be discussing. So I'm joined by the usual team in the form of James Forsyth and Fraser Nelson. And then we also have a special guest today, James Johnson, partner at JL Partners, the polling firm, and also former super spad in the Theresa May years. So we'll be getting his insight as well today. Now, we're going to talk about a few different topics, but just to start, James Forsyth, we've got two Jameses, so I'm going to juggle that. So James F, can you start by giving us an update on where we are with this Brady Amendment? Because we started the week with the news that there was a growing Tory rebellion, a plan to try and limit the emergency powers the government have on coronavirus to give MPs more power. And we're not sure if the Speaker is going to call that amendment. In fact, it looks like he is not going to. So has Boris Johnson managed to avoid a battle, or are they still having to deal with this?
I think there is a recognition in Downing Street that with more than 50 Tory MPs having signed this amendment, even if the Speaker doesn't call it, they need to do something to deal with this backbench anger and irritation. So I think we will see some kind of offer from the government coming soon about votes. Possibly, some of them will possibly be retrospective rather than before something happens, because the government is very keen to argue that it needs the ability to move quickly. But I think the government are recognising that they need to do something, and the government's own actions aren't helping them. Today, for example, Gillian Keegan, a minister, was asked on the Today programme about what the rules said about the restrictions in the North East, and she said, look, I'm terribly sorry, I can't answer that question. I don't represent a North Eastern seat. Then Boris Johnson was asked, after his speech today on skills, what these restrictions meant in the North East, and he gave an answer that seemed at odds with the guidance, and he has just tweeted out saying, I'm sorry, I misspoke, and correcting what he said. And I think the more the government makes these errors, the harder it is to justify a lack of parliamentary scrutiny. It's very hard not to think that if there was proper parliamentary scrutiny of what the government was doing, the government would be forced to get its ducks in a row more.
Fraser, surely it's also harder for the government to justify increasingly high fines and penalties for those people who don't follow the rules when you have quite senior in the form of the Prime Minister and other members of the team not knowing what the rules are.
Yes, and this is a real difficulty for the police as well, because they're supposed to implement rules which a lot of people have lost track of, but differ in various regions of the UK. And it's also hard to align them with kind of common sense as well. I mean, in the old days, it was quite simple. The initial instructions were stay at home, don't go outside unless you're exercising. Now there are so many variations of that, that it's pretty difficult to, I think, to hold somebody up to be a criminal if you let those things slip. But the thing is, I don't think the government is really pretending that this is a sustainable situation. The way I see it, it's a kind of a holding pattern. That right now, we're not sure if we're going to follow France or Spain or even this terrifying balance trajectory that we were shown by Patrick Vallance on Monday last week, where he suggested cases doubling until you get 50,000 a day. Now, since then, we've had 7 days of data, and we suggest that we're not doing anything like that. So it could well be that with another week, perhaps 2 weeks of data, the government becomes more assured that we're not following this very depressing trajectory, and that we're experiencing more of a second bump rather than a second wave. So they can relax a lot of restrictions that are already turning out to be unsustainable.
Now, James Johnson, so James J, it's quite clear that this government and this number 10 particularly likes to govern by focus group, pays a lot of attention to polling, and certainly Tory MPs, of which there are many these days, who are quite agitated by the number of restrictions. They blame in the fact that the government is too guided by opinion polls. And often when you poll things like a 10 p.m. curfew, lockdown restrictions, they poll rather well. So where is the public now, do you think, in terms of support of these restrictions?
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. You know, in the polls that we've seen, we saw some polls by YouGov and Delta Poll, showing there was actually quite a lot of support for these measures, whether it's the latest ones in or whether it's actually an appetite to see more things close. We've seen that throughout the pandemic. I think a lot of that stems from that sort of, you know, heightened sense of fear of the virus that we saw in the UK. But look, I think a few things have certainly changed since back in March and April in terms of the public mood. The first is, hitting on what Fraser said there, a sense of fatigue. And actually, it's really interesting in the focus groups that I do. When we're talking about lockdown restrictions and, following the rules, back in March and April, not one person would ever have admitted on a focus group with seven other strangers that they had even slightly crossed the line in terms of a rule or a restriction. Whereas now people are a lot more open about it and they speak a lot more openly about how they're frustrated and about how long it's going to go on for and how, again, you know, they feel like, you know, they can sort of, you know, make shortcuts in terms of common sense. And the other element to it as well, which will also clearly be on Number 10's mind, particularly in terms of the relationship with the Chancellor, is the role of the economy. Now, if we look back in March and April, a poll by Keck CNC showed that, you know, 74% of the public said put health first, you know, put health first, even if it creates a recession or a depression. That number is now down to 53%. So it's still a majority, but you are seeing that gap between health and the economy close. So there's this increasing group in the public who are actually saying, hang on a second here, we need to look at the economy too. So it's a much harder public situation for Number 10 to navigate than back in March and April. It also probably means, by the way, that they have more leeway to lead public opinion rather than just follow it.
And just on that, James J, it's interesting that you say that in certain focus groups now, people will actually admit to occasionally flouting the rules, because there is data that we saw recently about how many people are abiding by the rules. And it was pretty surprising in the sense that you hear people saying en masse, you know, over 50% support a 10 p.m. curfew. Yet the number of people who go to self-isolate when they are told was well below 50%, according to this piece of data. So does that tally of what you're hearing in the focus groups? Do you think it is a case where people are almost saying one thing, or, you know, saying they like one thing because they don't think it affects them?
There is an element to that. I think that people certainly, you know, do, I think they are genuinely acting in good faith. I think most people actually do, you know, still respond very positively towards the, you know, protecting the NHS message. And I think most people are generally being careful. But there is just this general, it's human psychology, right? You know, there is this general welcoming of these restrictions. But you're absolutely right. You know, at the same time, people are just not disobeying them, not flouting them. The whole thing hasn't broken down. I think it's always important to stress that, you know, wherever we see, photos of, you know, people gathering outside pubs after 10 p.m. or, you know, the house parties, you know, most British people are probably actually at home, watching TV or in bed, being very sensible. So, you know, that sort of group, particularly in the red wall seats, you know, the slightly older voters, there is certainly still that sense, you know, that we need to come together and follow the rules. It's just that there's slightly more room for leeway and for what people would sort of describe as their own common sense taking a role compared to back in March and April.
James Forsyth, we've heard various times about the hawks and the doves in cabinet and how it splits. But I wondered if you could just tell us, you know, as things stand, as James Johnson was talking about, there are clearly changing circumstances. It might not be that drastic yet, but definitely it seems like the public are getting increasingly concerned about the economic consequences of this. So what's the mood in the around the cabinet table? How did the factions divide? Who was pushing for what?
Well, okay, I mean, this is the interesting question here is comes back to what Fraser said at the beginning. I think so much depends on what happens with the spread of the virus. I think the witty and valance presentation which they made on the Monday to the public, they had made to the Sunday on the cabinet in a briefing not that much different from this. And I think a lot of people were prepared to kind of listen to their concerns and accept, okay, we need to act. And I think it is worth noting that the actions the government took were nowhere near as dramatic as some of the things that were being floated a little bit beforehand. So this wasn't a kind of circuit break. Hospitality wasn't shut down. Instead, it's shutting an hour earlier than it otherwise would have done. But I think, as Fraser said, the more people sense that valance scenario, in inverted commas, isn't coming to pass, the more cabinet pressure there'll be for a more relaxed approach to this. I think there is also the cabinet are being influenced by the mood of Tory MPs, which, as we said, You've got more than 50 MPs signing the Brady Amendment. You've got real anger about what is happening to young people at universities. I think there's a feeling that, you know, that it is hugely unfair to persuade people to pay large amounts of money in both tuition fees and rent, and then to essentially kind of incarcerate them in their university halls of residence. So I think the mood is definitely beginning to turn. And I think it's interesting that these rules on household mixing, I think that is where you are beginning to see some tension. Because I think previously there had been a sense this was a rather neat solution to the problem, which is you can see people from other households, but not in your own home. So you have to kind of go to a pub or a restaurant and spend money. I think there's now becoming a lot of Tory pushback on this, on the grounds of, hang on a second, the Tory Party is meant to be the party that stands for kind of family and community. What are you doing banning people from seeing their relatives, seeing their families? And I think there's also a growing fear among the cabinet about what do you do about Christmas. Now, I think this is particularly difficult because from a virus point of view, Christmas is a very bad thing, which is you would be having multiple generations inside a house in December. I think most people are not going to be outdoors, they're going to be indoors. And as quite a decent number of those people have travelled from kind of all around the country to be there. And I think that is one of the concerns, which is, you know, do you go all out to try and save Christmas, or do you level with people that is actually going to be very difficult this year?
James Johnson, how important is Christmas to voters? I keep hearing from some wishful Tory MPs, but also some in government, about the various strategies to save Christmas. One idea being almost a Christmas ceasefire, where you'd increase the number of households you can mix with. Others, the idea that you might have really strict restrictions in November in the build-up to try and make it so you have that space. And everyone seems to agree that, in a way, the Prime Minister must do this because he'd get lots of positive headlines for saving Christmas, you know, about a week before. Do you think that if we are told to spend the Christmas with the households we're currently in, so, you know, single household, no mixing, that is going to be difficult for the government? There will be a big backlash.
I think this is actually somewhere where sometimes MPs misread public opinion. I think that the most important thing for the public is that the rules are fair and that they're evenly applied. If there is a case for, you know, much stricter restrictions and the government is able to effectively message that case, then actually I think the idea that, you know, these things could be lifted or relaxed, you know, for the Christmas period, I think quite a lot of voters will turn around and say, well, hang on a second, that doesn't make any sense. You know, surely that's going to lead to the virus rising, or they're just doing this for political gain, or they're just doing this because Boris Johnson wants to save Christmas. So obviously the best case outcome clearly is to, you know, have the cases going down or level or whatever, so we don't need to have that. But if we are in that situation, actually, that sort of sense of fair play is much more important to voters than, you know, whether they get an exemption on Christmas Day.
Now, as this is a live podcast today, also a video one, we are open to questions. So if anyone has a question they would like us to get to in the next 15 minutes, please write it in the chat function and we'll try and do as many as we can get through. Now, I want to talk about a few other things beyond the Tory party, but before we do, Fraser, I believe that you may have a graph you can show us. Ultimately, when we're talking about that balance, in some circumstances described as a horror graph of where we could be heading on coronavirus, how is the reality tallying with that?
Well, we've spoken a lot now about what things are going to look like at Christmas. Will things get better? Will things get worse? And of course, we don't have to wait anymore, because since we've seen the valence graph showing what it would be like on the ascent to 50,000 cases a day, we've now been able to track it every day. So we can see on this graph, the red, that is the scenario of cases doubling every 7 days. So we get to just under 50,000. And then we've got in blue what happens if we were to follow France, and in yellow what happens if we were to follow Spain. So we can see now the black graph shows that we're following France. We're just a little bit above France, but nowhere near the exponential increase envisaged by Patrick Vallance on Monday. Now, that doesn't mean to say it's not serious. If you were to look at the deaths in France and Spain, they're significant, but absolutely nowhere near what things were back in March. So this is quite significant, I think. Now, the scenario as well I'm showing here on the graph we did back in the Spectator office imagines what was happening if we were 28 days behind France and Spain. That's our premise. In reality, it's difficult to put it in exactly the number of days. Right now, when we started the second round of lockdown restrictions, that was the premise, that we're 3 weeks behind them. If we look at what's happening there, it could happen here unless we act now. That was part of the rationale for lockdown as well, by the way, that if we lock down dramatically with all these draconian measures, we might be able to avoid the deaths seen in France and in Italy. In fact, we ended up with more COVID deaths per capita than anybody else in Europe. So I can see why Boris Johnson would look at the scenarios now and think that his gut feeling tells him that Britain usually ends up with the worst. If you look at any continental scenario, Britain will end up hard hit because we did last time, maybe because we're a more globalized country, maybe for demographic reasons. But so far, anyway, his worst fears do not seem to be realized. If this stays the case this time next week and a bit beyond it, then we might be talking about liberalizing some of the restrictions, and there might not be any more talk about Christmas being cancelled.
Now, if we see unwinding of restrictions, I think that is clearly something, if so long as the public believes it's safe, that could increase confidence in the government. And I think one of the worrying things the numbers have at the moment is if you look at polling on the handling of coronavirus, it is going in the wrong direction in terms of faith in the government. You mentioned earlier, James Forsyth, this idea that Gillian Keegan on the morning round this morning couldn't talk about the restrictions in the North East. Boris Johnson had a similar problem. And one of the attack lines we keep hearing towards the government, particularly by Keir Starmer, is this idea of incompetence, not being a competent government. I was wondering, Spectator James, when we're looking at a situation where the government is continually accused of being incompetent, is it something that gets to number 10? Are they worried about it? As attack lines go, is there an acknowledgement that actually in the long term it could be quite damaging to them?
Well, Catherine Balls, I think the thing that you saw was Boris Johnson initially tried to attack Keir Starmer for being kind of Captain Hindsight. The idea was, oh, you say all this now, but, you know, we're dealing with a global pandemic about a virus about which no one knew anything about just a few months ago at the start of this year. Cut us some slack. I mean, the problem for the government is the public mood has shifted. In the first wave, the public were very mature and were prepared to cut the government a lot of slack on errors made. This time round, I think it is much harder for them to do so. And the government aren't helping themselves by some errors. You know, for example, exam results, I think, was a particularly bad mistake because the UK government should have been able to see the mess that the Scottish government had got itself into and see that problem coming down the track. I think it stretches credulity when Dido Harding declares that they didn't anticipate that schools and universities going back. You know, remember, 1 in 5 of the population in England is either attending school, university or nursery or works in one of those settings. But the return of those institutions was going to increase the demand for testing. You know, again, that is a question of competence. And then the government makes a big song and dance about introducing the rule of six on the grounds that it's simple and obvious and easy for everyone to understand. And then the Prime Minister gets it wrong in a televised national press conference with journalists. You know, all of these things don't help. Keir Starmer's central strategic insight, to my mind, is that oppositions don't win elections, governments lose them. And his type of competence-based attacks on the government, they are never going to set pulses racing. You know, they are never going to lead to tens of thousands of people rushing off to sign up to Momentum, right? But they could begin to chip away at the government. And it's only one poll, but I think that poll showing the Tories behind this week has rattled Tory MPs a little bit, because I think Tory MPs have, you know, what has been keeping a lid on their discomfort with the government has been these regular Tory poll leads. If those start to go away and the Tories start to fall behind the polls, I mean, I should stress, you know, there was another poll out on Sunday which actually had the Tories ahead. There's a YouGov out this week again with the Tories ahead. But if the Tories start to be regularly behind in the polls, I think the mood in the Conservative Parliamentary Party will become even bleaker.
Now, do send any questions you have, because we'll do a quick fire before this podcast ends. James Johnson, do you think that the competence line is cutting through your voters when you're doing focus groups? Is there a sense this government is not handling things well, which is unique to this government rather than just any government would struggle with a pandemic?
It is certainly cutting through, I think, particularly in the last couple of months, actually. I mean, the test and trace, concerns that voters have around, you know, us not having, you know, the sort of same system as perhaps other countries do has certainly cut through to voters. I think actually going off my focus groups, that's behind this sort of most recent narrowing, I think. You know, this real frustration that voters look at places like Italy, look at places like Germany and say, well, why can't we have it here? There's also this general general real frustration about confusion and messaging. Now, this isn't just sort of, you know, somebody, you know, the British public having a bit of a moan. You know, there is this real feeling that, you know, this sort of confused messaging. The Matt Lucas video, you know, where he says, you know, he sort of does a parody of Boris Johnson saying, you know, go to work, don't go to work. You know, that has had enormous cut through with voters. It reminded me a little bit of the there's no money left note that was left in the Treasury by Labour for the Conservatives in 2010, which, you know, still comes up in some of my focus groups today, by the way. But it's a little bit like that in that it's a totemic thing that voters keep bringing up to really sort of vent their frustration about the government. So the competence stuff is cutting through. However, I do think that it's going to take quite a bit more now to get the Conservatives down from that 40% position in the polls. Keir Starmer has won back Remain voters. He's won some Lib Dems over to the cause. He's even won a few sort of, you know, soft Conservatives. But in terms of winning back those red wall voters, it needs to not just be about competence, but also about values. And a good example of that is the schools debate. So, you know, Labour's line was very much, you know, the Conservatives have messed up exam results. Actually, for that to really resonate with red wall voters, those voters need to be questioning whether the Conservatives care about schools in the first place, whether they care about the NHS in the first place, whether they have their values at heart. Now, at the moment, those people in the red wall still have those doubts about Labour more so than the Conservatives. So that's where that gap really, really needs to be closed if Labour want to make an advance. And one final thing on that, Katie, if I may, is this is why the Dominic Cummings trip to Barnard Castle was, you know, so important and remains to be so. And it still comes up every time in the research I do, because it gets at that core of, you know, is Boris Johnson's, you know, does Boris Johnson, you know, look out for his right-hand man more than me? And, you know, the more that message comes through, the more worrying it is for the government.
Now, anyone who watched Gogglebox this week would have seen that Keir Starmer's Labour conference speech didn't quite cut it, with the sofa critics at least. So, Fraser, James is talking about this idea that ultimately Keir Starmer needs to offer more than just Boris Johnson being bad or bad at handling things. How do you think Keir Starmer is doing as Labour leader? Because often the media, everyone's quick, and I think some of us included, to say he's done much better than Corbyn did in his first few days. But obviously there's a big step between that and really being in contention for number 10.
Yeah, well, there is basically a fast track and a slow track he could have taken here, and he's taken the slow track. What he could have done is taken a few more bold positions on how to handle the lockdown. He could have been talking about, for example, from the word go, he could have been complaining about the school closures, which I think the government now admits were a calamitous mistake, but we didn't hear a word of that from the Labour Party. He could have been talking about more, even now, about the victims of lockdown, about the inequality it will deepen, about the educational damage that will take years to repair. But instead, he's decided to support the government in pretty much all of its lockdown positions. So he has not been an opposition leader. He hasn't given opposition when it comes to that. Now, if I were him, I probably would have done that, because I think that from a left-wing, from a sort of progressive perspective, the sheer amount of inequality that's going to be left or rot by lockdown will be something that will keep them talking for years to come. He can't, though, say, I warned you not to do it this way, because he didn't. He signed up to everything, just in the same way that the Tories signed up to high Labour spending in the Gordon Brown years, and they weren't able to say, I told you so, because they didn't. But then on the other side of it, Keir Starmer has played a card of competence. He wants to look and sound like a safe pair of hands. That means not being particularly bold. That means not being showy, just looking like he would be a more plausible leader. Now, a couple of weeks ago, I was talking to George Osborne, and I found, to my surprise, that he, Osborne, former Chancellor, was saying that Keir Starmer is, in his view, somebody who looks as if he could walk into number 10 that evening and do the job. Osborne thought this was quite an accolade for an opposition leader, because normally it takes many months to get to that status of plausibility. So I can see why he's playing the competence card now. Perhaps it's a bet, but he doesn't have to be flash. He doesn't have to trip up the government. All he needs to do is to stand there and look reliable at a time where the government, it doesn't stop from the self-inflicted wounds and from looking pretty far from competence.
Now, I only have a couple of minutes left before I get told off for letting this podcast run on too long. So I'm just going to go to a few of the audience questions. I'm going to read three out at once and then we can divvy them up. A question from Joe: are you working from home? I can answer that. We're actually all in a hotel, but separate rooms. There is social distancing going on, I can promise you. Another question. Do you think the voluntary basis isolation is the best way to protect the vulnerable? And then the final question is, on university, should the government cut tuition fees for students and pay out the rest if university, or should universities have to pay? And that's obviously referencing the fact that lots of students have gone to university, effectively trapped there and questioning what all that high annual fee is for. Fraser, which of the questions on universities and self-isolation would you like to take?
I'll give you my quick thoughts on both. The funny thing about self-isolation is I think this is already happening to a degree. We're already seeing the virus spreading a lot amongst young people, hardly at all amongst the over 70s. Now, the government says it could be a matter of time before it trickles its way up the age groups, but it could also be that the more vulnerable people are simply taking more precautions. So this is happening on a voluntary basis, rather than having the government mandate it. On universities, several private schools cut their fees because kids were getting far less than what they'd paid for. I really don't see why universities shouldn't be made to do that. I think it's a bit of a scandal, actually, because they know that young people are between a rock and a hard place right now. They're hardly going to go traveling the world in an era of quarantine. We're not going to go and get a job. Unemployment's about to surge. So they've got no option. And to actually snare students into signing up for their accommodation and then tell them only afterwards that there wasn't going to be any campus life, I think is utterly reprehensible. And I do think universities have indulged in that, should be made to pay a financial price.
James Forsyth, do you want to have a final word?
I think segmenting the population is an underexplored idea. I think you saw how topsy-turvy it's got, where in Scotland this weekend, the population was essentially segmented, but with young people being told not to go to bars and restaurants so that older people could, which it seems to me a kind of very odd way round of doing things. I think there is definitely a case for more segmenting the population. I think on universities, I think Fraser is I would say this, wouldn't I? He's my boss, but I think he's totally right. And I think there might well be a mis-selling case that could be held against some universities. I think lots of universities waited for people to sign their leases on their expensive accommodation and then told them everything was going online, or moved everything online at the first sign of trouble when there was obviously going to be difficulties when you put that many people together in a small space.
With that, thank you to all my panel. Thank you everyone for listening, and do stay tuned for more events today and tomorrow.
You can subscribe to The Spectator for 12 weeks for only £12 for our print and online editions, plus get 6 months of digital access free to The Telegraph. Go to spectator.co.uk/telegraph.